Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Hello and welcome to Retail Focus. Trent and Leighton Kling with you as we discuss Walmart's purchase of Jet.com today, as well as a merger between two distribution businesses that could affect the grocery industry. But our first news item of this episode, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics' last report, the U.S. added 255,000 total jobs in July. While that in and of itself is not necessarily remarkable to the retail sector, retail did add about 15,000 jobs in July. This is less than the 26,000 jobs the retail sector was adding per month on average prior to July, but not maybe as robust a growth as it had been on average. Still, Leighton, brick-and-mortar retail stores continue to add jobs. What does this say about the future of the retail industry?
Well, you know, I think the future is bright. A lot of people have been talking about the growing e-commerce segment in regards to the overall retail industry. But I can say that, you know, if you look back just in the three-month average, retail jobs have increased 11,700 positions over the last year for 2016. And so I think really you're looking at a healthy sector. A lot of people are getting hired, and this isn't temporary jobs. So you're seeing a lot of increases towards the winter months when you think of seasonality and how retailers like Walmart and Best Buy have to hire temporary workers to kind of deal with the excess of foot traffic. But here you're seeing healthy growth in the months that aren't really tending to see temporary hires. And so I think that's the most important thing here. However, the one thing that we can really say is a bad thing here in this latest report for July is that if you compare the growth to last month in June, employment grew about 29,500 jobs. And so that was actually 10% of the total amount of job increase. And that's really good for the month of June. And so I feel as though we are slowing down a little bit, but it looks like it is a bright spot for the retail sector.
It's a very odd year as far as retail is concerned, because a lot of people speculated that brick and mortar was being ruined. And in fact, if you just looked in January and February at all the announcements coming out, at the announcements from Macy's and Sears and Kmart about store closures and the headlines based off of that, you would have thought it was all gloom and doom for brick and mortar retail. Since then, though, sensible minds seem to have prevailed, and we're seeing a lot of growth in the retail sector. Other than businesses that are shrinking for other reasons, maybe demand shrinkage or possible loss of market share to online companies, GNC comes to mind, we're seeing pretty consistent 1.5% to 3% same-store sales growth. And as you see that same-store sales growth, you'll also see those job increases that we've talked about across the board. Not only have jobs increased in the retail sector, again, we're looking at hundreds of thousands of jobs in the last 12 months overall. You're also looking at hourly earnings increasing. Last month, hourly earnings in the private sector rose 8 cents or 0.3%. Hourly wages are up 2.6% for the year. So this surpasses the current inflation rate. And when you're looking at some of the retail employees that perhaps have been holding jobs this entire time, rising wages might be one of the reasons that employers aren't adding quite as much help over the last month plus.
Yeah, to be honest with you, you and I were talking before this recording of the podcast. We were really saying that we expected to see lower retail hiring because of the wage increases. Something that we've talked about a lot on the Retail Focus podcast is wage stagnation and how that's kind of going by the wayside for 2016. You're actually seeing, as you mentioned, hourly wages up 2.6%. surpassing inflation. And so this is something that you would tend to believe would cause a stagnation in hiring, but it's really not the case. As you had mentioned, hiring actually could be a little bit more if the hourly wages were a little more stagnant, but this is really good for the consumer and the employee. I feel as though they're going to have more spending power with those higher wage increases, and it'll be a cycle, if you will. So the employees are going to be spending more at the very outlets that they are working. Overall, you're seeing the wage increases not really have such a detrimental effect that a lot of economists and analysts have been speculating over the last 6 months or so. You keep hearing about minimum wage increases for the fast food industry and a number of metropolitan markets talking about $14, $15 an hour minimum, and people saying that that's really going to cause an increase in automation for these service industries and an overall lesser amount of hiring. But apparently that's not the case, at least for the retail sector. And the retail sector, by the National Retail Federation's terms, is actually quite a broad spectrum of service jobs. I feel as though, again, and I'm going to repeat myself here, this is a really bright spot for the economy in general and for the retail industry. I would like to mention, however, that consumer sentiment, this is from Thomson Reuters, actually did decrease in comparison between June and May of this year. It decreased from 94.7 to 93.5. And so that's kind of contradictory to what we're seeing. We're seeing, as you mentioned, solid same-store sales, finally wage growth, increased hiring, yet lesser consumer sentiment. So I don't believe that's really in line with the overall feeling that consumers are having right now. That, again, is just one survey. I don't think that that's necessarily an accurate depiction of the market in the U.S.
And not only are same-store sales increasing, but it seems like on a weekly basis we're talking about store openings and sustainable levels of store openings. We're not seeing explosive growth necessarily in any one sector, but we talk about businesses and companies that maybe have 5 to 600 stores nationwide, increasing by 20 to 30 stores a year. So that increase does exist. They're not eliminating too many jobs. They're not eliminating too many positions. If anything, we've seen a greater trend towards, rather than closing certain stores down that are underperforming, moving those stores to different neighborhoods. That's something that Tuesday Morning has kind of sought out as a method of boosting sales in some of their underperforming stores. And we talked about CVS last week having that very same approach. I know, though, that something that concerns you a little bit as far as the long term is concerned is the fact that a lot of numbers suggest that only around 3/4 of people nearing retirement age in 2010 only had about $30,000 saved for retirement. So does that mean perhaps some long-term flux as baby boomers begin to age, retire, and leave the workforce?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a possibility. You know, I think those 2010 numbers reflect the current state of the economy and how much people are truly saving. This overall sense of consumerism is a bit of a detriment. So really, if you look at the economy as a whole, I think the current level of sales is almost unsustainable because a lot of these products aren't durable goods. And so people are spending, and spending is going up overall. As you had mentioned, retailers with the positive same-store sales are still creating some efficiencies by closing down underperforming locations. However, I think long-term, people need to be more concerned about how much they're saving and where they're saving and thinking a little bit more about the future. Life expectancy is growing. People are living a longer life, but people need to understand that because of that, you are going to have to be saving for the future if you want to maintain a decent quality of life.
One of the things that Walmart had mentioned to kind of pivot and talk about a different point in their last quarterly earnings release is the fact that rises in salaries and wages for their employees has actually produced greater spending at Walmart. Now that those employees have more money to spend, they're spending a lot more of it at those stores that are seeing the biggest amount of growth. This harkens back to a story I remember being told about Kmart some 20 or 30 years ago, wherein the employees during payday, they would actually get their paychecks cashed in the back of the store, thus encouraging them to spend some of their paychecks as they worked back towards the front of the store as they were leaving for that particular day. But we are seeing in very real terms that trend begin to reveal itself. And certainly Walmart seems to see it in their bottom line, and in overall their top line revenues have boosted because of their wage increases to their employees. And you would guess, as we've discussed before, that rises in wages for certain retail businesses will force other retail businesses to try to keep up with the Joneses. It's no longer only Costco that pays their employees what many consider a very good retail wage.
Yes, competition within the retail sector has become a little fiercer than many had expected. So you are seeing wages naturally grow. But then, as you said, Costco offers an amazing wage and has for quite some time. They actually just, as we reported, raised their minimum wage in some markets to $13 an hour, $13.50 in the more competitive markets. But overall, you're seeing Walmart, as you mentioned, reaping the rewards from this. A lot of employees do have the option to use the money card, the Walmart money card, as a compensation mechanism, whereas typically you would just get a check or a direct deposit. They're really looking at this as an opportunity to have customers spend their increased wages at their locations, as you say.
One final note, as I alluded to at the beginning of this story, I think a lot of the talk about brick and mortar retail shrinking, about brick and mortar retail dying, I think that was blown out of proportion. And overall, these job reports certainly indicate that brick and mortar retailers, as well as e-commerce retailers, are finding a way to succeed as 2016 wears on.
Moving on, keeping on with Walmart. Walmart makes it official after weeks of rumors. They are purchasing Jet.com for $3.3 billion in cash and stock. They ended up making this press release late on Monday. It turns out they are going to be spending $3 billion in cash and about $300 million in stock, and they're going to be dispersing payments to Jet.com over the next few months. They didn't say how they were going to do that, but they are saying that they are looking to assess the total value of Jet.com and really integrate that into their platform where they can utilize the many millions of members that they've created.
A lot of the headlines surrounding this deal claimed that this could be the deal that helps Walmart put Amazon in the rearview mirror. I'm not willing to go that far. And in fact, I think there's a lot of question as to where the synergies are in this deal. Jet is slowly increasing their customer base, but they've had to do so spending healthy amounts of money. In fact, some would say too much money on their marketing efforts. As far as Walmart is concerned, according to the Wall Street Journal, Morgan Stanley analyst Simeon Gutman says that the deal doesn't address the key issues that we've actually been discussing on the podcast for months with Walmart, and that's fusing their e-commerce site, Walmart.com, with the stores and with their distribution assets. And I actually tend to agree with Gutman. What we've seen from Walmart is the inability to tie in all of their distribution assets and their distribution systems to their e-commerce site. So you can't always get site to store. Sometimes you can only get site to store. Sometimes you can't ship to an address. Sometimes you can order certain products and have them deliver within a couple of days. Sometimes you can order a product and not see it for another 3 to 4 weeks. Not sure how this Jet.com deal specifically addresses some of those issues, but those issues are occurring with items such as televisions and larger purchases on their site. Jet.com's focus much more to the grocery industry, and Walmart.com has struggled a little bit in their e-commerce portion of their grocery industry. They're trying to make things a little bit smoother in terms of their curbside pickup programs. But I fail to see a strong connection between what this acquisition does for Walmart's e-commerce as far as developing synergies between the two, between Jet.com and Walmart.com.
Jet.com recently announced they have a product selection of about 12 million products, a total merchandise value of about $1 billion. So they're really trying to infuse that into Walmart.com's platform. However, if you think logically about that product selection, the 12 million products, Walmart.com probably has many of those. As you say, they're really going to be looking at the distribution platform and the overall marketing strategy that Jet.com has been so successful at. Jet.com is a private company, so we didn't yet have a report as to whether or not they are a profitable company, but we do know that in the recent months in 2016, they have been adding about 400,000 new customers each month, and they are in a favorable demographic, the millennial. So typically, when you're looking at the global e-commerce platform growth, you're looking at a younger demographic that's eager to buy online and capitalize on all of those deals. And I think that is where Jet.com's focus has been over the past few months. It's been an expensive focus, considering that all of that marketing usually means lower margins. But this is something that I think Walmart.com really wants to take advantage of. And Jet founder Mark Lohr will actually join Walmart as their CEO of e-commerce. So they obviously have a lot of trust in the platform. They are paying a premium for it, and they are really hoping that it ends up being something that they look back on as a value-added opportunity.
One thing I can say for sure about Jet.com is that their mechanisms, as far as their website is concerned and as far as the point of sale on their website, seem to work a lot more smoothly than those on Walmart. So there certainly are things that Lohr can add to the equation as their new CEO of e-commerce. Still, sometimes in these deals, that's just a throw-in to make sure that the deal gets completed. We don't know what his future will look like within the company. But again, Jet.com focuses primarily on shipping to residences, and they do so relatively quickly. As we mentioned, their fulfillment seems to work a little bit more fast than Walmart.com's does. However, one of the things that Walmart has underlined is the buy online and pick up in stores or the curbside pickup options that are available at certain outlets throughout the country. There's actually a study that was conducted late last year, and published this year in June that showed that margins actually suffer on some of the products in the grocery section that you buy online and pick up in stores, in part because you are spending on e-commerce and e-commerce marketing, and in part because it takes physical employees in those stores to be able to shop around for customers and fulfill those orders. It will be interesting to see which synergies Walmart explores as far as product addition and which ones they don't. Either way, going forward, I think time is going to ultimately tell how many synergies Walmart can pull out of this deal. I just don't know that overall this seems to be sensible for Walmart. It seems as though what they're doing is just trying to collect e-commerce assets, but as of right now, nothing what they've done in the e-commerce sector has worked as well as it has for Amazon. After all, Walmart's e-commerce sales accounted for only 3% of their overall sales last year, so there is definitely room for growth. It's just so far, Walmart hasn't been good at much of what they've tried in e-commerce.
You mentioned some really good points there, and I wanted to touch on a few of them. Jet.com has the experience with just selling e-commerce, as you mentioned, selling to your home address. Where Walmart is showing its vulnerability is to try to separate their distribution between their e-commerce platform, Walmart.com, and their brick and mortar store. I feel as though this really shows how desperate Walmart is overall when it comes to executing on those distribution channels. You're seeing Walmart as a brick and mortar retailer that has been successful for a number of decades, has grown to an enormous size, and does many billions in sales. However, they're trying to integrate a mobile and e-commerce platform that really hasn't succeeded because they're competing against the larger Amazon, which only solely focuses, up until recently at least, on shipping to your home and those distribution networks. They don't have brick and mortar to worry about. So really, no other retailer other than Walmart has been in this space trying to execute on both. And so I feel as though the acquisition of Jet.com is really going to test the longevity of Walmart's ability to compete in this space. Something that, as we're talking about Amazon, that I wanted to mention is that Walmart's global online sales for this last quarter increased 7%. If you compare this to Amazon, Amazon during the same comparable quarter increased 25%. So already you're seeing that Amazon's still having all of this momentum. And Walmart, if you look back at their comps for the same quarter last year, they were at 17%. So if you compare those 2 years from Walmart.com sales, you're seeing a slowing in growth. That's never a good sign. And also, if you look at a new data set just put out by Cohen & Company, it revealed that roughly 54% of Amazon shoppers in the U.S. are now Prime members, and that number indicates a 45% increase year over year. And so if you're really looking at keeping members and keeping your online shoppers, I think the subscription model is where it's at. Amazon.com, through their streaming video and music sections, are really able to have those value-added areas that they're acquiring the customers and being able to keep them and showing those customers value year after year. And this isn't even mentioning Prime Day, where they're able to drive sales and give those Prime members really good deals for that period of time every year. And so that's what Walmart.com is up against, having more value, not just having a platform, but giving customers something and not only allowing a huge selection of products, but giving them something more like streaming video and music, a special day every year, not just Black Friday. Overall, it is an uphill battle for Walmart.
Just as a postscript to this story, we also know now that the deal has gone through that Jet.com has yet to show a profit. However, that in isolation doesn't necessarily mean too much, as Amazon went several years at the beginning of the company's existence without showing a profit either. We transition back into brick and mortar retail. Early last week, it became official after many rumors had circulated through the media that Associated Wholesale Grocers and Affiliated Foods Midwest Cooperative have agreed to merge the two cooperatives' distribution businesses. Both are actually retailer-owned cooperatives that supply over 3,800 stores between them in 30 states. Now, going forward, members of both co-ops will be Associated Wholesale Grocer members. Now, both of these companies serve as largely independent grocers, not unlike Ron Rhodes, who we had on a few weeks ago, but also any stores with either the Affiliated Foods banner or even the IGA banners, and even some convenience stores as well. So this affects a great number of people, but when you talk about synergies, I think the synergies are much more obvious in this deal than they are in the Walmart.com and Jet.com deal.
Yeah, I think the synergies here are really going to be a positive going forward. As you mentioned, both grocers are actually retailer-owned co-ops. They're focused on driving a lower price to their customers with this acquisition. I think they will utilize their distribution networks, and they've really honed down the processes within both of the companies to deliver products in a timely fashion. And honestly, this is going to really push away further competition. If you look at the overall space, Kroger dominates the grocery business, followed by Walmart. By joining forces and merging, having this done will enable the two companies to deliver an even lower price and build their brands with their customer base. I think a lot of people in these regional areas that they're located understand what a co-op is and how special that is to that overall area. And they look at that, and if a Walmart comes in or a Kroger comes in, they're not necessarily going to go there because of the lower price. They want to stay true to what they believe and what they see as an opportunity for the overall public. And I think that is with staying with Associated Wholesale Grocers and Affiliated Foods Midwest. They are looking at this as an opportunity, again, to push away competition and create a better, brighter future for the both of them.
Some of the generic brands that the two companies already distribute include Best Choice and Shorefine as examples. And when you look at suddenly buying power of 3,800 independent grocers, or grocers that are more or less independent, that is significant, certainly. That puts you in the same number as the Albertsons, Safeways, and the Krogers of the world. So now these stores aren't operating at as much of a disadvantage. Now, granted, these two companies, Associated Wholesale Grocers, had 3,000 stores already, while Affiliated Foods Midwest had 800 stores. But ultimately, what you're looking at here is the possibility that costs will be driven down for those independent grocers. And certainly the distribution chains will be a little bit more convenient across the board between the two companies. Now, there are reports, certainly, that there might be some loss of jobs as a result of this merger. There's one particular distribution location in Kansas that is rumored to lose a number of jobs. So there is rough news on that front as far as employees are concerned of these distributors. At the same time, this is positive news on the pricing front for customers of these independent grocers. And Leighton, it's also of note that there's still a slight slight chance, even though it's been announced already, that the merger won't go through.
Yeah, that's right. They had reported that the merger is official. However, there could be a potential hiccup towards the end of the year as the members of Affiliated Foods Midwest Co-op, their shareholders still have to approve this merger. So the boards of both companies have actually already unanimously approved this. But again, the Affiliated Foods Midwest Co-op still has yet to approve. The shareholders need to look this over and they will then decide whether or not it looks good to them. But because of that, they haven't given a solid date on the actual closing between these two companies. And it is rumored to be at the end of the year sometime. So again, we're waiting on that shareholder approval, but it looks as though it's going to go through. It's certainly strong enough so that media reports have gotten a hold of this, and it looks like a sure thing.
We'll discuss the other news stories on the Retail Focus podcast here in just a bit, including earnings from Natural Grocers, a Whole Foods competitor, as well as a purchase in the mattress retail industry. But first, Armin Vitt of the graphic design firm Under Consideration LLC and the very popular blog Brand New will join us to talk about retail brands, retail logos, and where some improvements could be found across the retail spectrum.
As most of our listeners know, from time to time on the Retail Focus podcast, we like to delve into design elements of retail stores. And today we'll talk a little bit about logos, both of retail stores and of their products. In order to do that, we brought in Armin Vitt from Under Consideration LLC. He's a co-founder of that graphic design firm established in 2007. They take on limited client work while generating their own projects, initiatives, and content. He also spearheads the design blog Brand New, which covers logo and identity redesigns and garners over 1.25 million page views a month. It's really a fantastic blog, and I find myself spending a massive amount of time on it each week. Armin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We'll start with perhaps the most basic question when it comes to retail store logos. What are the keys to creating a strong logo for a retail store? What are some of the aspects that you look at then when evaluating that logo?
I think the main thing is recognizability from wherever you are, whether it's from 1 mile away, maybe too much, but you know, that's not too far-fetched. If you're going down the highway, you know, if you're looking down a bunch of shopping malls and there's a giant Starbucks sign that you can see a mile away, you know, why not? So a lot of it is, the main thing is recognizability at various distances, something that has to be consistent. It can't be a logo that changes too much from time to time. That's something that can adapt to a bunch of different kind of like awnings and canvases and places where that logo might have to be shoehorned into. So adaptability is very important. And then also just something that is evocative of what the store sells. The Apple logo doesn't sell apples, but by now we all know that that Apple logo sells computers. So anything that creates that connection between the product and yourself, that's always a bonus.
As far as the actual design of a logo, is there a magic bullet that maybe automatically makes a retail logo impactful, or does it certainly depend from brand to brand and from store to store?
I think the one thing that would separate the good from the bad would be simplicity and memorability. So it's something that it's so easy to draw or so easily reproduced that whenever you barely see it or wherever you see kind of like a hint of it, you'll just associate it with whatever that product is. So the simpler that the logo is, the more it will stick in the mind. So I think that nowadays there's been a few posts going online about, you know, can you draw the Apple logo from memory? Can you draw the Volkswagen logo from memory? And some of them, despite being really simple logos, they're really hard to draw from memory. So it's really imperative to have something that is the least complicated possible so that, you know, it can stick in people's minds.
In talking about logos that are fairly uncomplicated, you've mentioned Apple. What are some of the other store logos or retail store logos that stand out to you as strong logos conceptually as far as simplicity is concerned?
I would say, I don't know if you consider gas stations retail, but you know, I guess in terms of something that's mass market, I think the Shell logo is really impressive in that it's almost like Apple. It's a Shell, but they don't sell Shells. It's just that we've associated Shell with gas stations for such a long time that it's such a powerful symbol, and it's so easy to see, and it stands apart from all the other ones that it becomes a really iconic thing that you can see from anywhere. Kind of like on the opposite end, you have something like Starbucks, where it's a fairly nuanced logo in the sense that there's a mermaid in it, and that mermaid has a crown and stars, and at some point you used to be able to see the two tails, now you don't. At some point you used to be able to see the navel or a little bit of the boobs, whatever. But it's still a somewhat complicated logo, but again, no matter where you see it or how you see it, you recognize it. And sometimes it's not even about the logo, it's just that green color of Starbucks. You see that green awning or a green facade somewhere, and you know, no matter where you are in the U.S. or now anywhere in the world, there's something comforting about seeing that green. And that green, you know, maybe other companies or other products or brands have a green similar, but it's just that green for Starbucks works wonderful in just creating that instant connection.
I want to change gears just a little bit and talk about the process of logo redesign, or perhaps the frequency of logo redesign over the last 5 to 10 years for a lot of retail stores. Has there been a trend, do you feel like, over the last 5 years that you've noticed in terms of redevelopment of identity and redevelopment of logos in retail?
Yeah, I think the trend has been going towards a minimal design approach where, you know, again, like the Starbucks logo went from a more complicated logo to something that had less elements. The Apple logo went from a long time having those gradients and shadings and bevels to just being black and white. So there's a lot of those changes where it's about minimizing the amount of elements that people have to recognize. And, you know, a lot of it is a reaction to kind of like the early 2000s where more was more and there were gradients and swooshes and things that you could do production-wise that were impossible before. Like before, you could only do things in one or two colors because that's what you could do budget-wise, and then it became easy to do everything full color. So for example, the UPS logo, when it changed in 2004, it went from the flat little package that had a bow into a shield that was very detailed and highly rendered. And the only way they could do that was because the technology was there to reproduce the logo on Crocs, on Dropboxes, all that kind of stuff in a way that wasn't possible before. But now UPS has done away with all the shading. Another UPS logo always appears either in white or just in yellow. So there's a little bit of backlash to the heavier ornamentation to something much more minimal.
And you talked about, you know, some of the gradients being put on the back burner, some of the multicolored logos being put on the back burner. As you look throughout the retail store landscape, what are some logos or identities that come to mind that you'd like to see maybe tweaked or changed to kind of fit that concept of a logo or the new 2016 concept of the logo?
I would say AT&T, the stores. I think they went through a point where they introduced that globe logo that, you know, it went from being flat to something that was literally like a marble, and then that influenced a lot of the retail stores where it was just a lot of big bold graphics. And I think that logo could be, and I think that's what they're starting to do right now, where they're trying to move away from the three-dimensional rendering into something that relies less on that kind of like visual trick to communicate. And I think that's kind of like a brand that would, the retail stores would benefit from a simpler approach.
A lot of news outlets covered the fact that a couple of months ago, Walmart announced that it was bringing back their smiley character. And although that's not necessarily a logo, is that something that we'll begin to see a little bit more of, is some of those retro characters or retro brand identifications from the 80s and 90s kind of making a comeback?
Oh, yeah. And I think we're seeing that a lot, where a lot of retailers are bringing back not just characters, but even like logos and typefaces as supporting elements. There's a retail grocery chain in the UK called The Co-op that literally just reintroduced a logo that they had in the 1970s. And it's amazing how nice it looks now, whereas, you know, it had been forgotten for so long that it's now it feels fresh. And there's kind of like a revival for 1970s typography and, you know, kind of like in 5 years, the 1980s aesthetic is going to come full on. So I think we're going to start seeing a lot of crapper keeper kind of graphics, for better or for worse. You know, I kind of love them myself. I know, like, all those VHS tapes, I think we're going to start seeing a lot of those graphics a little bit more. And yeah, it's a way of, you know, building from things that have already been proven, things that speak to an older audience, but that may have interacted with them in their childhood or, you know, early teens or whatever, and then it's exposed to a new audience. So you could say that it's a little bit lazy and that, you know, what happened happened, but it's a nice way of honoring the past and kind of like celebrating the history of a company.
And 5 years, the entire landscape might look like a Lisa Frank folder cover, if you will. Our guest is Armin Witt. He's a co-founder of the graphic design firm Under Consideration LLC and curator of the fantastic design blog Brand New. And he's discussing logo design in retail with us. I want to kind of pivot to some of the in-store packaging topics that have been discussed over the last 6 months. And a lot's been made over some of the rebranding for private label products. And I know you had a great recap of Target's redesign of their Market Pantry line on your blog, Brand New. What are some of the trends that you're seeing take shape as far as the redesign of these private label brands?
Yeah, I think when private label brands started to be more relevant in the early 2000s, maybe late 1990s, they all tended to be like white boxes or white tubes with minimal typography. It was a way of saying, like, here's this product that is cheaper than the rest, and one of the reasons why we make it so cheap is that it's unadorned. It doesn't have all the powwow graphics of most mainstream consumer brands, and here it is. And then, you know, over the years, as those choices became more economically engaging for the consumers, I think the quality of those products has risen in recent years, and as such, they stand on their own as good quality products. So I think now the companies behind those private label brands, I think they're more comfortable putting a little bit more visual energy into them so that they stand out and against kind of like this endless barrage of other competing products, and they can still beat them on price. And, you know, on top of that, now they look pretty good. I mean, I think the Target stuff that you mentioned, it looks so good, even better than some of the brands that it's competing against. So it's nice that they're evolving in a way that still feels like an evolution from where they started, but they blend in a little bit more with the other packages. And, you know, you might even be mistaken in choosing it because you think that, oh, you know, this is made by Procter & Gamble or Unilever or Nestle or whatever, and it's just the in-house brand. It's kind of like a good testament of how companies have treated it more seriously and used design to their advantage.
We kind of referenced this in terms of retail stores, and I wanted to bring it back for the in-store packaging. Is there a specific product area within, you know, maybe a department store or a grocery store that you feel could use redesign help or is maybe overdue for a redesign across the board where maybe the packaging and the logo work isn't as strong as it could be?
You know, I think it would have to be either the milk section. It's just like plastic thing after plastic thing. You never know what's made of almond, what's made of coconut, what's whole, what's half. You know, there's a lot of variations and they all, for some reason, look the same. So that's one thing. And then another thing that always baffles me, and you know, I don't think I consistently pick the same product twice, you know, within a month. And those are egg cartons. Like, there's hundreds of eggs, and I can't tell them apart. And a part of it is because they come in, you know, the cardboard thing that they just print one color on them, and they all look the same. So I think it's kind of like the utilitarian parts of the grocery store that no one cares about, but I think they would benefit from a little bit more distinction.
When you think about it, there's not really a milk brand that's out there that has produced a carton other than a white background. What are some of the things in terms of the milk section that maybe a designer could do to make a product stand out?
Yeah, I think just kind of like maybe not latching on to the fact that it has to look white. I mean, if there was some milk that looked black, I would look at it. I mean, it would just be like, what the hell is that doing? Like, that doesn't look like milk. And maybe just by challenging the other things that you see on the shelf, that might be enough to warrant attention. The flip side to that is that, you know, if it doesn't look like milk, people are not going to buy it. But I think somewhere in between, something that breaks from the category but still plays within the rules might be a good thing for milk.
Great input there. Before we let you go, the annual Brand New Conference that you guys put on is coming up, and this year it's in Nashville, September 15th and 16th. What can people expect from the conference this year, and what are some of the highlights you guys have planned?
You know, with the conference, one of the things that separates this conference from other design conferences is that we focus on corporate identity and brand identity. So that means people designing for corporations or, you know, at the corporate level as well as for consumer-facing brands. So, for example, we have one of the creative directors from Nike. And, you know, we see so much Nike stuff that we just take it for granted that it just comes out of the womb from Nike looking great. But, you know, there's a lot of people driving the design. So I'm looking forward to hearing about how that actually happens. On a personal note, there's a legendary fashion designer in Nashville who's been doing all the suits for country singers in Nashville and around that have all those rhinestones and the kind of like nature ornamentation and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And that's as much creating brands, because he's the one credited for dressing Johnny Cash in black. And, you know, he makes suits for Dolly Parton. And working for those people is as much as creating a brand for Nike or Google or whatever. And I'm looking forward to, I'm going to do a Q&A with him. His name is Manuel, just like on a one-name basis, like Cher, like Madonna, just Manuel. And he does really amazing stuff, and I look forward to, I'm going to do a Q&A with him. So that's going to be a highlight. And then just one more would be the creative director from Sesame Street. You know, that's a brand that we've, many of us grew up with, but, you know, we just see the show, but there's so much else that goes behind it that it deserves some kind of like some attention for people to see what happens behind the scenes.
Now, if people want to attend the conference, where can they go to find details? And I understand there's also a webcast for the conference.
Yeah, we do a live webcast, and then and we sell videos of the sessions afterwards. So even if you're just interested in one or two, you can do that. If you go to BNConf for Brand New Conference, bnconf.com, that's where you can look at all the speakers and register for either the website or even buy videos from our previous conferences.
It's Armin Vitt from Under Consideration LLC. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
It was my pleasure.
To find out more about Armin's work, you can visit the Under Consideration website online. That's www.underconsideration.com. Their brand new blog is at underconsideration.com/brand new. I'm telling you, it's a fantastic website. Be sure to check it out. I spend a ton of time on there on a weekly basis. You can also follow them on Twitter at UCLLC.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Moving on to our final two news items in the Retail Focus podcast, Whole Foods competitor Natural Grocers reported earnings, and they met earnings per share consensus estimates for the second quarter in a row. They are seeing managed, consistent growth as sales for the third quarter came in at $179.3 million. That's a 13% increase year over year. Same store sales increased just above 1%. The rest of the increase comes from new stores that they've opened, and it seems like Natural Grocers is clipping away ever so slightly at the overall Whole Foods market share.
Yeah, you see the overall trend with millennials is to shop all natural or organic, and that's definitely what Natural Grocers specializes in, and they want to be viewed as such. They want to be viewed as one of the competitors within this very tight space. 10 years ago, the space wasn't as murky. Honestly, the space wasn't as busy. You would see Whole Foods and really see that they're the market leader, and that a potential future for Whole Foods would basically be the leader in this space. But Whole Foods now has to come up against Natural Grocers, which actually had a 13% year-over-year sales to $179.3 million. And this, again, is for their third quarter fiscal 2016. Sales so far this year hitting $524.5 million. That's quite high. Again, a 13% increase year over year there as well for that same period, the three quarters of 2016. Same store sales, a metric we commonly discuss here on the Retail Focus podcast, came in almost 2%. They hit 1.8% positive same store sales. For year to date, they're actually at 2.1%. So again, a metric we talk about often, 2-3% is a healthy retailer in this current economic environment. Overall, that would mean that they're actually slipping slightly in sales for the third quarter if you compare that to the previous two quarters same store sales metrics. But net income for the quarter hit $2.7 million. So their actual operating cash is up and they are operating a very healthy business that people are really driving to go to. They are so confident, in fact, that they've opened more stores for this quarter, 15, beating the 12 that they opened in the third quarter of 2015. So I think overall, this is a very good report for Natural Grocers. Their stock, however, is almost flat, if not down 2-3% after having reported earnings. That's a little bit odd. In my view, they've actually met guidance three of the last four quarters. And so if you're meeting consensus guidance and analyst expectations, I just don't know why the stock is underperforming so much. I think you could probably attribute it to the overall growth isn't that of a Whole Foods. They're not really dominating the sector, but they are growing at a healthy, consistent pace.
Yeah, if you look at the two companies in competition with one another, Whole Foods operates over 430 stores in 42 states, and meanwhile, Natural Grocers operates 118 stores in 19 states. So they're still lagging behind in terms of overall store count. You look at the top line revenue also for Natural Grocers, and sales came in at $179 million for the quarter, as we mentioned. When you look at Whole Foods, their quarterly earnings much higher than that. In fact, the last quarter that they announced for, $3.7 billion. So Whole Foods is making much more per store. That being said, Natural Grocery stores are smaller square footage, so they are a little bit easier to manage in those terms. But Whole Foods still dominating this particular sector as much as they could. Natural Grocers just looking to kind of clip away at some of that growth. And you mentioned it, store growth is still pretty strong for Natural Grocers. They've already opened 15 stores in the first three quarters of this fiscal year. And more millennials, as you mentioned, are desiring to eat natural food. For a person that has not visited perhaps a Natural Grocers store and is more familiar with the Whole Foods concept, what are some of the differences, Leighton, between Whole Foods and Natural Grocers when you walk through the door?
For those hardcore connoisseurs of organics, I think their selection is actually a little bit better than Whole Foods. Whole Foods is 365 is typically all natural, so you won't see ingredients that are all organic. However, I think the supplement sector is really where you start to see the difference. They dedicate a large portion of each store to having all natural supplements, to where people can have a vast selection of products and brands that are really known to this fervent customer base. Overall, if you look at the failing earnings of GNC about 2 weeks ago, you can see that they're actually taking a chunk out of that market because people are more motivated to go to a Natural Grocers to get these kinds of things than to go to a GNC that has actually been in the news recently for having had tainted supplements. So I think if someone needs a supplement, needs a certain vitamin or mineral added to their diet, I think they're more apt now more than ever to go to a Natural Grocers. And I think if you compare that to a Whole Foods, where yes, they have an aisle or two dedicated to that, but not six aisles, I think that is the differentiator here in this perspective. But if you look at the overall store, it is a clean store. It is a smaller footprint, as you mentioned, if you compare it to a Whole Foods, but it is a clean store. They keep the store really clean, and they even have an area within many of the stores that offer a dining area where you can eat or snack on something that you've bought. That would be a similar item that Whole Foods has. They usually have in Whole Foods a market area where you can eat fresh pizza and those kinds of things there. But I really do like the store designs, and they keep it simple. I appreciate the marketing efforts as well to expand and broaden the knowledge of their new product selection. They offer many samples that display new items that are in certain markets, and they also have many coupons too to really inform the customer of things coming in and to try stuff out that they hadn't before.
Overall, the impact on the stock, as you said, is negligible. In fact, the stock trickled down just a little bit after the earnings per share came out and the overall earnings for that third quarter came out. The stock currently is around $12 per share, which is about 50% lower than when they started the 52-week trailing period. And it's an interesting mix because you see Whole Foods taking a few hits on the stock market because of earnings that were perhaps less than expected. But as you mentioned, Natural Grocers has managed to meet expectations three of the last four quarters, and still you're not seeing much movement in the overall stock price. To what do you attribute that?
Honestly, I would attribute that to the slow growth that we talked about. 13% growth is a good metric overall if you're looking at the retail sector. But if you're looking and comparing to other stores, you're talking about Kroger, who can grow through acquisition and just has so much cash on hand. And then also Whole Foods, which is coming out with their 365 development. I think that people and investors are really looking at Natural Grocers as a solid company, but one with not a lot of growth prospects, at least in the short to midterm. And I think the company has actually forecasted that. They said, listen, we know our business, we know the markets that we need to grow in, but we're not going to grow that rapidly. They're taking their time, they're leasing a lot of their buildings, and so that obviously takes time. And I think that that's a good strategy for them. I think if you were to grow too fast and maybe perhaps expand through acquisition, I think it would be an unhealthy way to go going forward. Moving on to our last story for Retail Focus. In a retail segment, we rarely, if ever, talk about the mattress industry. Mattress giant Mattress Firm has actually just been acquired by South African firm Steinhoff International Holdings. This is a company that is actually known for its furniture holdings and its experience overall in the furniture business. The deal in its entirety is worth approximately $3.8 billion, a 115% premium based on the company's former share price. This is a massive acquisition. Mattress Firm, again, the leader in this segment. You see a lot of growth in a lot of metropolitan areas here in the last couple of years. Trent, what do you think of this acquisition, and do you think they overpaid?
Yeah, that's certainly an enormous premium. 115% premium over the current share price is remarkable, especially considering the fact that Steinhoff International is actually assuming all of the Mattress Firm debt. So as you mentioned, the real deal is probably closer to $3.8 billion. Maybe they see value in terms of growth in the U.S. Mattress Firm has become more popular, certainly, as they compete with the likes of Furniture Row and then mattress-only outlets besides Furniture Row shopping centers. Mattress Firm is based out of Houston, and I think they would be certainly borderline insane, and the shareholders borderline insane, not to take this deal. If you are a shareholder of Mattress Firm, certainly very happy to hear this news, because the $63 per share that the company stock exploded to, far above any estimates for 52 weeks on the stock. To give a little bit of background to our listeners, Mattress Firm has been around since 1986, and it's been expanding through acquisitions, including the purchase of one of their rivals, or one of their main rivals, Sleepy's, back in February. The expansion has resulted in rising costs because of integration between those two chains. And one of the things I find interesting about Mattress Firm, this being an area that we don't really cover a lot on the Retail Focus, is unlike a company like Furniture Row that owns a lot of their own properties, they actually use leases, and a lot of leases, especially in premium shopping areas, high traffic shopping areas, for their retail showrooms.
I hope Steinhoff International really did do their due diligence before having offered to buy out the company, because honestly, I feel as though it is a little bit of a bad spot if a company leases most of its spaces. Leases have been going up steadily over the last 5 to 10 years. Just this last year, commercial space that's for sale, not lease, has actually increased 6.7%. and this was for the first quarter of 2016. And so, honestly, the owners of that real estate aren't going to eat those higher costs. They're going to transfer that onto the lessee. And so this is going to be a long-term expense for Mattress Firm. They've really grown quite considerably. Again, in the last 1 to 2 years, they've just exploded the amount of locations. And so I feel like that's going to be a potential liability in the long term as these spaces get more and more costly. But something that Mattress Firm does have on their side is the fact that they do have that brand name, that brand loyalty, and they oftentimes have better than average warranties when you talk about the mattress industry. That's one of the things they really pride themselves on, is having warranties that really stack up to the competition. And so when you combine the dynamic of having a strong brand with the liability of having a lot of leases and having just grown so much that you don't know if it's sustainable or not, it's really a question mark here, a question mark that I don't think can be accounted for, 115% premium from Steinhoff International. But for the sector, I think it's growing. The mattress business is growing considerably, and it's going to be a business that's around forever. Everyone always is going to need a new mattress at some point in time. So they're also having the benefit of lower fuel costs. Obviously, they offer delivery at most of their locations, and with the lower costs in fuel and overhead as of late, that is something that they're going to be looking at as a green spot for the company. Also, wage increases. That's something that we've just talked about on this very podcast. Wage increases are expected to only continue. However, a lot of this doesn't apply to Mattress Firm because the large amount of their workers are actually commission-based. So this is actually another bright spot for Mattress Firm because they're not really susceptible to the increasing wages in the retail segment.
Again, there's just uncertainty there regarding the leases, and some businesses certainly do that on a pretty regular basis. We talked about Tractor Supply Company more or less having the same policy where they will rent build-to-suit locations rather than purchasing properties for their stores. You do have higher leasing costs in the future, but one of the things that when we talk about retail wage stagnation going away, I think it'll actually benefit or trickle down to benefit Mattress Firm in the future, because new mattresses are only something that you really splurge for if you've got a lot of expendable income. If you're in a situation where there is wage stagnation, you're going to see a lot more of people hanging on to mattresses for longer amounts of time, waiting as long as they humanly can before actually purchasing a new mattress. It's very similar to a lot of other industries, the automotive industry, for example, where you see people fixing up older cars in the case of a recession or in wage stagnation, and then purchasing newer ones when that recession or wage stagnation ends. The very same thing is the case with mattresses. That being said, I do believe, as you had kind of referenced earlier, that a 115% premium might be a slight overpay, especially considering they took on about $1.4 billion in debt. Well, as we do every week on the Retail Focus podcast, we'll each give you one story that we're looking ahead to over the next week or month, and we'll begin with Layton's.
PetSmart just announced this Tuesday that they're adding specialty crafted tunes at more than 1,400 of its locations. This should be capitalizing on every single location where they have a pets hotel, an area that you can put your cat or dog or whatever pet you may have while you're shopping for your pet supplies or pet food. So this is something that they hope will actually calm the pets down and actually make them a little bit more mellow as they enter in the store and take their time to kind of calm down as there may be another pet beside them in the pets hotel. This is an interesting feature from PetSmart. This is something that's going to be a differentiator from the large Petco competition. I feel as though this is going to be interesting to see if it actually works out and if the owners of the pets are pleasantly surprised that they can actually choose from these almost 1,000 songs that they're going to be offering.
So each pet's owner will be able to choose a personalized playlist, or how exactly does this work?
Yeah, they actually have these upbeat playlists, they call them. They appeal to the specific owners. So dogs and cats can have their own special tunes, and it would be at the owner's request.
That's very interesting. My story that I'm looking ahead to is also in the pet sector. Blue Buffalo Pet Products will give their earnings on Wednesday. And the reason this is important as far as retail is concerned is Blue Buffalo is one of a number of companies that is trying to capitalize on a new natural pet food push. Of course, a lot of people recognize Blue Buffalo from the marketing campaigns and the commercials that they've introduced both online and over cable television and network television. Blue Buffalo is somewhat of a bellwether for this category, and this category has been red hot of late, and it helps to bolster sales of pet retailers like PetSmart, Petsco, and Pets Way, among others, because it tends to be higher margin, or you at least make more money per purchase if you're PetSmart or Petsco. So it helps your top line revenue as a pet store, also helps your margins. So we'll see exactly how popular Blue Buffalo pet food has been when we reconvene for the next Retail Focus podcast.
It's interesting to me, Trent, that how large the overall pet supply and pet food industry is. A multi-billion dollar industry here in the U.S. People here tend to take care of their pets more than any other nation, it seems. And definitely retailers are looking to capitalize this with ever-growing margins.
In terms of pet ownership in the U.S., it's estimated that about 70 to 80 million dogs and about 75 to 95 million cats are owned in the United States. Around 40 to 45% of all households in the U.S. have a dog, and 30 to 35% have a cat. So you're right, a lot of households have pets, and these companies, as well as the corporations like Blue Buffalo, trying to capitalize on that and make sure those pets are well cared for. That's all for this week's Retail Focus podcast. Again, thanks to Armin Vitt of Under Consideration LLC and the blog Brand New for joining us and discussing retail logos. He certainly brought a lot of insight to that. Feel free to follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast. Visit our website, retailfocuspodcast.com, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or any other podcast delivery service. For Layton, I'm Trent, saying so long until Food Focus drops on Friday.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.